Essentially, just to recap, and also, I think I just want to start with a little bit of Hashkafa, which is relevant to Yonah Diyoma and to our topic. Again, we've commented about how Migo is tied in to our concepts of din and justice in general, and it tells us a lot about credibility and a lot about the inherent validity of a taina, which is relevant in a broad hashgafic sense as we approach our Yom HaDin, or as we stand between now Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So there is a lot that one can glean from the concept of ego. I just want to explore hashgafically for a minute before getting back into it. There's another element which I think is also a connection between Yom Kippur, in a sense, some Gedalia that we spoke about yesterday, and about the topic of Migo, and the topic of Ne'amanus and believing people in general. It's going to come up in a halachic sense today. I just want to comment for a moment on the hashgafic implications. Yesterday was Tzom Gedalia. Tzom Gedalia is a day devoted to Kabbalah Lashon Hara, in a sense, in the active sense, the pro-Kabbalah Lashon Hara sense. And the Gemara says in Maseches Nida and Daf Samach Aleph that Gedalia was killed because he didn't listen to a warning, and that he should have been mekabel the warning. He should have, I should actually phrase that differently, not that he should have been mekabel Lashon Hara, but he should have factored in the warning. The Gemara says that even though we have a prohibition of Kabbalah Lashon Hara, still, says the Gemara, Haylish Mevisha, that even though one is not supposed to be mekabel lashon hara, whatever that means, but nonetheless, one is supposed to be choshesh. So that's a complex distinction. And the Gemara seems to be saying, this is a whole discussion with Rishonim, what exactly are the parameters and what exactly are the circumstances. But when somebody's at risk or other people are at risk, so even though we normally have a prohibition of Kabbalah Lashon Hara, but you have to factor it in. You have to assume that the risk may exist and take the necessary steps for protection. And therefore, Gedalia was responsible on some level. So this Gemara highlights a very narrow split that we have. That Ne'amanus and believability is a complex topic. That on the one hand, you could believe something for certain purposes and at the same time express reservations for other purposes. And when it comes to this context specifically, so Kabbalah Lashon Hara, yes, we normally have a prohibition to accept disparaging information about someone else. It's a whole machlokes what exactly that means to accept it. That was a debate to the Chafetz Chaim and others. And we know there's a prohibition to speak Lashon Hara. Speaking Lashon Hara is easier to define. Okay, so you know you're saying something that is nasty, so we'll tell you don't say something that's nasty. But what does it mean to be mekabelit? And how do you decide not to be mekabelit? It would be simple if every time somebody spoke Lashon Hara to you, they came over and said, "Hi, I'm interested in telling you some Lashon Hara right now. Do you elect to accept or reject?" So then you'll push the reject button. Okay, so you won't accept it. But what does it mean not to accept something that you've already heard? So it's a complex point. Chafetz Chaim sounds like he understands in the Sefer that it means you're not allowed to believe it. You're not allowed to take it as true. And therefore, when Gemara about Gedalia said that he should have been choshesh, it means that he has to factor it in for protection, but that's different from believing that it's true at all. You shouldn't even see it as a suffix, which is a very narrow distinction, which led Chazon Ish, no less, to say that this is only lumbus and that there's no practical applicability. What does that mean? Not to treat it even as a suffix. And the Chazon Ish and others seem to understand differently. So Moshe Sternberg, for example, has a tshuva where he understands that Kabbalah Lashon Hara means that you shouldn't treat people differently based on what you hear. Again, outside the realm of protection. So protection is necessary. But beyond that, so you shouldn't treat the person differently because you've heard bad things about them. So the halacha seems to require a very delicate threading of the needle between what type of actions are taken based on what we believe about people and how far we shouldn't go in terms of what we believe about people. And the source for the Issa Kabbalah Lashon Hara, this is even more directly relevant to what we're discussing today. So how do we know that we're not allowed to be Makabel Lashon Hara? So the Gemara says that the Gemara in the last parak of Pesachim says a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, and that the Torah says Lo Sisa Shema Shav. So what does that mean? How do you translate that pasuk? Anyone want to suggest how you translate the pasuk Lo Sisa Shema Shav? It's very hard to translate. That Lo Sisa seems to mean that you should not lift something up, you should not support it, you should not bear it, you should not hold it, if you will. So you should not hold on to a shema as a report that is shav. So what does shav mean? So shav in some context means that it's unnecessary. So if that's the context, the pasuk is telling us not to be makabel lashon hara, so then to translate it as shav, you could understand. The Torah is saying one should not accept an unnecessary report, meaning that if somebody can tell you something that's important for the protection of others or yourself, so then okay, that's important, then you should accept it. But if it's pointless, if it's just gossip, if it's not of any significance, so then you shouldn't be makabel it, you shouldn't hold it up, you shouldn't give it support. So in that sense, that's what the pasuk is telling us. One should not accept a useless report. So if we normally understand that Lashon Hara is something which is true, Motzi Shemra refers to outright slander, while Lashon Hara is something which is true, so then it works well if we translate that word as shav. But it could mean, therefore, that even though something is true, but if it's unnecessary, if it's just gossip, it's not going to have any value, so then you should not be makabalic. Shav in that sense works well as well, because in other contexts, for example, we say we have a prohibition of a shvuas shav and a shvuas sheker. Those are two types of prohibited shvuas, of unjustified oaths. So if you take a shvua that the sky is green, so that's a shvuas sheker. That's a false oath. But if you take a shvua that the sky is blue, so that's a shvuas shav, because it's true, but it's unnecessary. Who needs you to come into Bezdin and swear that the sky is blue? We can all see the sky is blue. So that's also prohibited. But you see from that language, in that context, that shav means something which is unnecessary. So if that's what the pasuk means, it's very good. L'sisa shema shav, you should not accept a unnecessary report. But if you look, if you only have a chumash that has Rashi Miklos on the page, so you're not going to see that interpretation, because if you open up your standard Chumash with Rashi and Unklus, both Rashi and Unklus translate Shav over there as Sheker, which is hard, because if it pasuk means you should not accept a false report, so then if this is about Lashon Hara, and we normally understand Lashon Hara to be true, so why does the prohibition of accepting Lashon Hara translate to do not accept a false report? Right, how does that work? How does it work that the Torah tells us not to accept Lashon Hara with the words don't accept a false report? Anyone want to try to take a stab at that? How does that, how can you make that?
You mentioned before that Lashon Hara, that definition
isn't. It is true that there is some debate about that definition, right? So there are some who question the whole definition. So that would be one of the reasons to do so, that it seems like the Ksav HaKabbalah, other question, Chumash actually raised that question also, especially the Stechemet has a whole essay about this, that if you say that that's really the rigid definition, then things get a little bit harder, but it's not clear that the Gemara works off that definition. But the Rambam does, and the Chafetz Chaim Rambam seems to, and the Chafetz Chaim definitely seems to. So at least within their framework, is there a way to keep that definition and to also use the definition sheker for shav? Is there a way to maintain that Lashon Hara is factually true, and yet the Torah prohibits accepting Lashon Hara through the phrase, do not accept a false report? Right?
We've mentioned that people could think that they're saying the truth, but they're actually saying something else.
Right, so it could be that what the Torah is getting at here is that the speaker is saying something true, or saying something at least they believe is true, and what reaches the listener's ears might be false. And that could happen for a number of reasons. First of all, Rabbeinu Yonah assumes, in Shari Tshuva, Rabbeinu Yonah explains it, as essentially it's just a question of giving it unjustified credibility. That if you're going to say that something is definitely true when it might be not true, so then that's a problem. You have to acknowledge that it might not be true. As others point out, Rabbi Yonah's interpretation makes a lot of sense, because if you knew it was false, so why do I need a mitzvah in the Torah to tell me not to believe something I know is false? So maybe what it means is you don't know it's false. You know it may or may not be true, and you accept it as true without acknowledging that it may be false. Maybe that's the problem.
The report itself, the factual information conveyed in the report itself might be true, but the implications of it that are taken by somebody may be false.
Right.
Like, I saw that guy do this, the implication drawn from it may be that guy is a bad person and I should be mean to him.
Oh.
Whereas it is a false.
Oh, okay. That's excellent. So that's certainly another possibility. So one way to say that Ben Yonah's way is saying that the report itself may or may not be true and you're treating it as true. Or another way, and the Chafetz Chaim himself kind of gives his explanation, is to say, like Akiva says, that even if the person speaking is speaking the truth, but to allow it to have a negative impact on this individual, that is false. That the person will be painted in a false light by this true statement, and that's your responsibility. So the speaker could be saying something factual, but you are allowing him to be disparaged in a way that is not justified. That's your violation. And some of the Mefarshim on Chumash say that's the language of Sisa, Shem Lashav. The Sisa means to lift something up. Essentially, what the Torah is saying is that, okay, so you were told this fact, but it's up to you to decide how high to lift it, how much emphasis to give it. And for you to decide that it's more significant than it is, so that's your violation, and that's what the Torah is criticizing by saying, Losisa Shem Lashav. So that's certainly a viable interpretation as well. And then what Arya was saying is that it's also possible that the speaker could be saying something that he believes is factual, and nonetheless, it's not really fully factual. And this is because we have all kinds of cognitive flaws, we have all kinds of limitations on our understandings, so we may think we have the whole story, but we're not really conveying the picture fully. And it's fascinating. Sam, you want to comment about that?
I have a question about that. If the prohibition in the Torah is written speaking to the person who thinks that it's true, so why would you still use that word that shav and pasuk?
Because it's the emphasis is on how it's received, right? The speaker is saying true words, but the picture that is painted, it's impact related. Right? That even though the words that come out are true, but the words that hit the ears are false. So that the picture that is presented, the image that's presented, ends up being false, which is fascinating if you think about it in a couple of levels, right? That this really illustrates that this might be the whole structure. I think we briefly alluded to this in Parsha Shir a few weeks ago when we spoke about there possibly being a prohibition of even listening in the first place. That was a related topic. It came up in Parsha's Kisetse a little bit. But before you even get to that, just the idea that it's not really about the words, but the impression that could be created might end up being a false impression, even though the speaker is saying possibly factual things. And it's interesting that this could be a issue more for the listener than for the speaker. And that you find a couple of interesting things if you pay attention to the language here, that on the one hand, first of all, the source for the Issur Lashon Hara is most often cited as the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, Lo Seileh Charakhtei Ubiyamecha. And the source for Kabbalah's Lashon Hara, as we see today, seems to be the Pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim of Lo Sisa Shem Hashav. But the Gemara of Pesachim also contains a suggestion that this is also the source for Sukkot Lashon Hara, which is fascinating, because what it suggests then is that Lashon Hara, you would have thought that if you have two people, you have the speaker and the listener. So who's the criminal and who's the accomplice?
The speaker.
You would think of which?
The speaker.
The criminal, right? You would think that the real Isser is speaking Lashon Hara. And what do you need the listener for? What's his aveira? He provides the audience. He makes it happen. So he's the accomplice. It wouldn't happen without an audience, so he is the accessory. That's what you would have thought. But if the source is really from Lo Sisa Hashem Lashav, even for speaking, what that suggests is that it's the other way around, that really the real Isser takes place in the perception. It's really the listening that's the Avera. And the speaker is the enabler, that the speaker is the one making it possible to do the Avera of understanding it that way, and that that's the inverse of how you would have thought.
So then, does the speaker have recourse to say that I didn't necessarily mean for anybody to take me seriously?
Well, he has responsibility for how things are logically expected to turn out. If you read the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, so it's fascinating. You know, in general, there's always a debate about the Chafetz Chaim in terms of how the Sefer is presented, in terms of the expectations that it puts on everyone as far as carefulness of speech. That itself is a very high standard, and maybe it's a necessary standard, maybe not. It's a subject of debate. But what's also interesting, if you read throughout the Chafetz Chaim, that you see that he has a very high expectation as far as you're being able to assess the impact of your words. You have to be able to figure out how the people listening will receive it. Will they take it this way? Will they take it that way? So it's clear that, certainly from the Chafetz Chaim's perspective, but even without going as far as he does sometimes, that we certainly have an aprius for the environment that we create. And there is an obligation on the speaker to bear the responsibility for what's likely to come out. Which is why we also have discussions, there are gemaras that sound like just parenthetic, this is a much longer discussion, it won't take away too much time, but just to illustrate your point. So the gemara has a statement that if you say something in public, so then it's not lashon hara. So it's a big machlokas rishonim how to understand that. It sounds like, what do you mean it's not lashon hara to say it in public? It's more lashon hara to speak it in public. It's a much bigger audience. So there are four different views, at least in the Rishonim, how to understand that. But Tosfos is relevant to your point. Tosfos says that we're talking about something which could be interpreted negatively or positively. And therefore, the speaker should really worry that the listener may misunderstand his intent, that probably he means to speak positively, and the listener will take it negatively. So that would be his responsibility. That would be his problem. But because he says it in public, or any decent person would only mean to be nice, right? Because we all know that's always the case, right? Nobody would ever say anything mean in public. So then that creates the likelihood that the audience will take it positively, and he's maybe off the hook in that case. So the implications in that position are vast, and maybe we'll have an opportunity later in the year to talk about that. But for your question directly, you see what he's saying is that otherwise, you would have to worry that you are responsible, even if that's not your intent, but if this is a likely interpretation of your words, so then that carries a burden too.
You can also make that argument of Tosfos in the reverse way, which is if you say something that is neutral over a large population, there is likely to be one or two people that interpret it negatively.
Yes, that's also true. And that brings about other issues, which is a fascinating question in itself, and Rabbi Yona addresses that. I'm going to defer that so we don't take away too much time from Nigo, even though I'm going to connect this back to Nigo, but it's a fascinating point for discussion. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to come back to that. But what's relevant to our point right now is that it sounds like if you say this is the source for the Isser of speaking Lashon Hara, that really the whole Isser is in the perception, and that the speaker is enabling this perception, which is a fascinating way to see it. And if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Deis, the Rambam says that Hamakablo, somebody who receives Lashon Hara, is Yoser Meha Omro, that he's more guilty than the one speaking. So the other Svarim have a hard time with this. The Gemara talks about a prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara and seems to treat it as equal to speaking Lashon Hara, but to say it's even more, so that's harder to explain. Why should it be more? Some suggest that maybe the Rambam means because the speaker, all right, he's saying something which is disparaging, but maybe he at least did the effort to make sure that it's justified, and it's necessary, and it's true. But the listener will accept it as true, possibly without even making all of this effort to make sure it's justified, and therefore he's more guilty. It's interesting, they've done studies. There's a fascinating book, which I very much recommend, called The Water Cooler Effect, a very interesting discussion about gossip and hearsay. So he discusses that they did studies that show that people who listen to gossip give it more negative believability than even the speaker himself. The one who's speaking doesn't consider it as negatively as the people who are hearing it. And that part of this is because of, again, the cognitive limitations that people have, that they assume that they don't really have, they assume more than it's really being said, because they don't have patience or the bandwidth for details and for nuances, so they kind of simplify the whole story in their mind. It's okay, whatever it is, it's something bad. It seems like this guy did something pretty terrible. So even if the speaker means it in a more limited way, but the listener hears something even worse, and that maybe that's why there is this even greater emphasis on Kabbalah. So this is all very fascinating. I think that I want to make basically a couple of connections. Like I said, this is a Son Gedalia topic, but it's not just a tangential Son Gedalia topic, but it's very much a Yom Hadin topic, because we are essentially making the case to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that whatever we have done factually, whatever it may actually be the case that we have committed certain sins, but that we want him to perceive it within a framework in which we should not be taken so negatively, in which we should not be treated so harshly. And it is crucial that if we want that treatment, so then we have to be able to extend that treatment to others. We have to be able to say that even others, even if we know that, yes, factually there are certain things that are true about them, but that doesn't have to disparage them, that doesn't have to have an impact that goes disproportionately beyond the significance of those facts. And the same way that we're able to see those facts in that context, so too we ask that Kodesh Baruch Hu should be able to see us in that context and see that as in a similar context. There are some who suggest that part of Midah Keneged Midah, the idea that Kodesh Baruch Hu judges in a certain proportionate way, is that it's crucial that we have some appreciation for the system of justice that HaKadosh Baruch Hu utilizes. So if we are Rachmanim, if we are compassionate towards others, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be compassionate to us, and it's going to make sense to us. It's going to fit in with the conception of Din. But if we are very harsh in our judgment about everyone else, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to be able to be Yochel to be compassionate with us, because the system is not going to make any sense to us. It's going to look like he's just, as the Gemara puts it, avasrim, like he just doesn't care about anything. And that's not the way we're supposed to perceive it. So therefore, it's necessary for us to cultivate an attitude of not Kabbalah Lashon Hara, so that in the sense of, yes, the facts may be true, but it would be sheker to allow it to have too great an impact on how we perceive others. And so too, we want Kadosh Baruch Hu to see us the same way. Yes, we did action A, action B, whatever these evaders were, we did them, but as far as how it would paint the picture of us, it shouldn't be too big a part of the picture that's painted. And that's the attitude that we want for ourselves. That's the attitude that we have to extend to others. There are those who suggest that's also shot in the pasuk "V'ahavta l'recha kamocha," that the question is always asked, how is it that the pasuk can say kamocha? How is it that you can love others? That's possible, but kamocha seems to mean to the degree that you love yourself, that's how you should love others. So how is that possible? That's always a big challenge among the mafarshim. How do you understand that word? Remember when I was in Karen Yavna, somebody put up a sign on the wall saying that they found a lost item and whoever lost it should come claim it. And they wrote, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha on the sign. So somebody wrote graffiti on the bottom of the sign, commenting, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, said, I hate myself. So then somebody wrote graffiti under that. He said that the Kutzker Rebbe said that kamocha means that you should love others as much as you hate yourself. So whatever that means, I don't know, but the point being that kamocha, right, exactly, right. So the point being that kamocha is always a challenge. How exactly do you translate that? So there are those things. That's part of it, maybe. So however you want to factor that in, so the idea of kamocha is always a challenge. So for those who understand it, and we talked to Parsha Shoftim, I think, about the fundamental attribution error, that there are those who understand kamocha as meaning that whenever you have an issue, whenever you do something wrong, you do something that's not so impressive, so you always have a way of seeing it that it's not so indicative of your whole character, it doesn't reflect so badly on you, it's not really as bad as it looks, or it doesn't really say everything about who you are. So too, you can extend that attitude towards others as well. You can view other people in such a way also, so that you don't have to see them as bad as you could otherwise come to that conclusion, and you can extend the same attitude that you have to yourself towards others. So that's one of the major implications that the Kabbalah Lashon Hara Sugya of some Gedalia has to the soul of Yom HaDin Tekufa. But it's also crucial what we're saying here about this distinction between emes and receiving falsehood. Someone could be saying something true and you're hearing something false. That has very, very important halachic implications, I think, and they directly affect the sugya of Migo. One is that it means that you have to recognize that honest people will very often say things that are not true. Not because they are dishonest, not because you assess them wrong, they're still honest people, but the cognitive biases that we have and the various limitations that we have in processing information can come out that the person who's trying to tell the truth is saying something which is, for whatever intents and purposes, false. So that recognition is very important and plays a big role in Migo. I think people are going to see that just because somebody may have ne'amanus, whether it's inherent credibility or whether it is a halakhic credibility being bestowed in this circumstance, doesn't necessarily mean that everything they say is true. It's possible that they don't necessarily know the whole story themselves, or they don't necessarily fully appreciate the whole story themselves. And that's what we touched on this point a little bit last week. We said that when we find in the Migo literature, you find the phrase, Mala Lashaker, you know, why should he lie? So he must be telling the truth. So we have to be very careful as far as how to apply that. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who doesn't have a reason to lie is always saying factual things. It means that in the context of a taina that we see over here, when a person is advancing a taina, and he could be advancing a different taina, so it's unlikely that he's making up this taina when he has better options open to him. But it doesn't mean that everybody who says anything is always telling the truth if we can't figure out their motive for lying. It could be they have a motive we don't know about, or it could be they have no motive for lying. They're just wrong, and they don't recognize how wrong they are. And having that recognition is important both in terms of health of Lashon Hara and in terms of all areas of life and in terms of credibility. And that has an implication the other way as well, that one of the harshest labels we can give somebody nowadays is to call somebody a liar. You brand somebody a liar, people do that very quickly nowadays. Anytime somebody disagrees with you, so, oh, they're a liar, I think this, you think that, therefore you're a liar because your things have been different from what I know to be true. So already we have very limited tolerance for difference of opinion, the fact that somebody could simply perceive something differently. But even if a person is actually factually wrong, it's very often not because they're intentionally lying, but there are all kinds of factors that could lead to such a result. And therefore, it's important to recognize that there's a difference between saying something that's not true and being a liar, and how that affects ne'amanus is also at the heart of some of the Migo issues. Okay, so with that maybe we'll call it a tangent rule, that again, I think it plugs directly in to some of the issues that we're seeing and that we'll see today about Migo. So just to recap the important points so that we can progress today. So we've seen that Migo has a couple of different formulations. We saw that Migo could refer to believability that is granted by the fact that you have an alternative taina that you're not using that would be better for you, whether that means absolute believability or whether it means a halachic edge, you know, a little bit more believability, and therefore when you add up the points, you get more points than you otherwise would have. That's somewhat open to debate. We saw that there are those who understood it differently, that those who understood it as not necessarily about believability, but about what we called koach ha-taina, as the acronym say, that because that taina is open to you, whatever power it has is still in your tool chest and you can still use it to your advantage even if you're not actively asserting that claim. And we went through a couple possibilities last week of what that means, how do you understand that, and then we got into the questions also of how Pesha also relates. We saw basically three possibilities, that either Pesha Asa or Migo are two completely different things, that maybe Migo is about credibility or koach ha-taina, and Pesha Asar is about your being the authority and therefore you control things. And we saw another possibility that Pesha Asar is a form of Migo. We call Migo di'iboy shasik. If you wanted, you could have been quiet, so since you didn't, you have more credibility than you would otherwise have. Or the other way around, that maybe an ego is a subset of Tesh Asa, that maybe you created your own problems by not taking the escape clause, and therefore you also have the authority to direct how things are going to be interpreted. And then we started to get into the discussion of what exceptions there are to Migo. How does Migo work against other forces, against the Rove, against the Chazaka, against things like that? And we spent some time last week talking about the question of whether we say Migo Lahotzi. Do we say that Migo can work against a Chazaka? And we know that Rove generally does not work against the Chazaka. So it could be that Migo is like that. It's limited just like Rove. It doesn't work against the Chazaka, or there were some Rishonim, many big Rishonim, who say that it did work against the Chazaka. So we discussed some possibilities. Maybe the Migo was a form of Rove, like some Achronim say, like the Chachmah Shlomo says very specifically, or others, that most people know about their options, and therefore they get an ego. So it's limited to what Rove can do. Rove can only work without a Mukzah. So to Migo. Or it could be that Migo is simply equal to Rove, and that Rove can't do a Mukzah, neither can Migo. Or it could be that Migo is only a defensive tool, that it's something that's only given to a Mukzah and isn't given to somebody who is trying to take from somebody else. On the other hand, there are other Rishonim who said that it does work, and if that's the case, they understand it basically, it seems like, you have the full ability of the tanya that you're not making, and if this is a tanya that would work even lohotzi mamon, then that power is granted to you as well. I think those were some of the key points of what we discussed last week, just to keep us conversant for today. Everybody up to speed? Any issues? Any questions about any of that? Yes, sir.
The people who say that Nigo does work with lohotzi, say the first three reasons, which is Nigo can be a
well, yeah, no, so those two are more if you would say Migo doesn't work with Hotzi. Because when it comes to a Rove is not Motzi Min HaMotza. So if Migo is equal to a Rove, whether it's actually a Rove, that's why it's equal to a Rove, or it's just grouped with a Rove, then we could understand one reason why it wouldn't be Motzi Min HaMotza. We could give another reason why it wouldn't be Motzi Min HaMotza, in that maybe it's simply not a tool that anyone other than a Motzi has.
The
last possibility, if you want to say the other way, that it actually is Motzi Min HaMotzah, like a lot of the big Rishonim do say, then you could say that what Migo means is that you are given the full power of whatever Taina you have, whatever Taina you have available to you. And if that Taina is effective to be Motzi Min HaMotzah, so then Migo also. In other words, Migo is not an independent tool that has a certain degree of power. Migo means that you have access to a Taina. Migo is not a Taina itself. Migo means that you're given the power of an existing Taina.
It ties to the Kohatana.
Yeah, it would tie better to that one. Yeah. Well, maybe not 100%, but it would tie more strongly to that position. Okay, so if you recall also, so one of the other sukkahs which we said was very instructive as far as issues in Migo was the first mission in Bav Metzia. And the first mission in Bav Metzia says that if Morty and Aryeh are fighting over Talis and each one claims they get half of it, each one claims they own the whole thing, so then they have to pick a Shua and they split it in half. That's case number one. Case number two is if Aryeh says he owns the whole Talis and Morty says he only owns half the Talis, so then they again have to take a Shua and Aryeh gets 75% and Morty gets 25%. So all the Rishonim over there ask, well, why don't we just say Migo? That if Morty had said he gets the whole talis, he would have gotten the half that he wants. So why don't we let that be a power for him to get the whole half talis that he wants, and he should get that. So there were various answers among the Rishonim. Tosfos had given the answer that we discussed last week, that Migo lahotzi lo amrinan, that this would constitute a Migo lahotzi, and therefore it's not effective. But the Rishonim have many other answers. So we want to discuss a little bit about that today and tomorrow, and that will take us to the end of our sugya. So what other answers do you find? So one of the major other answers that we're shown and discuss is Migo me mamo le mamo lo amrina. What does that mean? Well, that would be Migo lahotzi. Migo me mamo le mamo, although they might be related. But Migo me mamo le mamo would mean that if I have a claim in another area, in another object, let's say there's another dispute. You and I have two disputes going on. and I could bring a claim from a different dispute. And that would give me enough credibility that I will also be able to get what I want here. So you can't use that as an ego for here. That's how some of the Rishonim maintain. So Tosfos says, but so other Rishonim say that when you're dealing with this half talis, so for Morty to say, well, I put on the first 50%, so I'm going to make that claim and get 50% of the other 50%, another 25%, so that's not going to work because that's ego mimaman lemaman that I want to use. Let's say if you divide the talis up, for simplicity's sake, let's say the talis is quadrants 1, 2, 3, and 4. So Aryeh is claiming he has 1 through 4. And Morty is claiming he has 3 and 4. So the question is, since he could have claimed all of 1 through 4, let's give him 3 and 4. So some of the Rishonim say no, because since he already acknowledged that he's not the owner of quadrants 1 and 2, so to say amigo from those quadrants, that would constitute amigo from a different claim onto this claim. And that doesn't work. Yes, sir.
Well, yeah, that means that we're evaluating his amigo power based on after he said the statement, not before he made his claim.
Well, really, it's all at once. You know, that basically, his essential claim, you know, amigo, was going to require in general comparing what he does say to what he could say. Right, so we kind of have those both on the table at the same time. That his current claim has to be taken together with the potential claim. So the actual claim is the half talus, and the potential claim is the full talus. So to compare those two, that's what these Rishonim say, that's mum mum mum.
Do you think it might be the fairest thing to do is the guy who's getting older, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still only gets half.
Are you for purchases? Yeah.
Right, and then the second guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gets half of what he claimed. So
right.
If he claimed 50%, he only gets a quarter. Essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last quarter would go to kind of like charity or as did. It would just be more fair so that, you know, at the end of the day, it's not the guy who claims, you know, all of it gets the most out of it.
All right, so you asked me a different question, which is a very important Bava Metzia question. It'll take us a little bit far afield, but just very, very briefly to tell you where to look on that. The first mission Bava Metzia. So the Rishonim all discuss that we seem to have a number of different ways to address disputed property. Sometimes it is that we split it. Sometimes we decide that one somehow wins over the other. Sometimes we do decide that Bezdin keeps it or waits until the yellow and the comes. And what the rule is, when we say one, when we say the other, that's the whole city. So it's a fair question. You know, why are we using Yahloku here? It's a great question. But that's a little bit outside the scope of Subis. We're trying to stick this stuff that overlaps with Supers. So that's about other parts of Supers. For our part right now, it's a little bit outside of it.
So basically, the reason why it's not amigo is because it's two different claims.
Basically, right. That's what.
So the problem is that we can't say he could have claimed the entire talis that he actually could not have claimed.
So let's figure out what exactly is the issue. Why would you say Migo and Mama and Mama well and Rita? Why is it a problem to go through the other claim would get through this whole pot? So why can't you use it? What's the issue there? How do you understand the problem with Migo and Mama and Mama?
Why would you be that?
Okay, that's a good way to address the question. So
why
would you? So let's say, so that's a fair way to ask it. So let's think it through. So if it's about nemanas, right? So if I have any way of getting something, right? So then maybe I should say, listen, if my whole believability comes from the fact that if I was a liar, I would lie more effectively. So then I probably think that Migo Mimama Lamama should work, right? Because who cares what the taina comes from? That if it's all about believability, so then unbelievable because I had a better lie and I didn't use it. If the whole premise of Migo is that unbelievable any time when there are better lies available to me, so then this should be such a case. Who cares what the lie is about? So how could you address that? So is that premise that I just said true? That if Nego is about, you're probably not lying, then let's treat it like that. Premise. Oh,
okay. Right, from the debating team. So here's the premise. If Nego is about credibility, then Nego me mama mama. Equals no problem. Is this premise true?
How could you argue on this premise? Yes, Akiva.
You could argue on the premise by saying that it has to be within the that credibility is only within the certain question that's being asked. Just because I could have lied with some. I could have given a lie that had nothing to do with the topic at hand.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if it's a debate about whether I own somebody money,
mm-hmm.
if I could have lied by saying that I don't know, actually, where I'm from, we don't have a concept of money.
Okay. Yes. That's a good example.
That's not relevant to the topic being to the question being asked. It would seem that credibility has to be in regards to the very specific question of whether I owe this person money in this particular case.
So I think you're on the right track. I'm going to tweak it a little bit, but I think you're on the right track. That essentially you could say that no, this premise is not 100% true, because maybe Nego me mama me mama means that you are going outside the bounds of credibility. That maybe credibility only attaches when your claim is at least reasonably close to the subject at hand. And if you're going to go somewhere else for your argument, maybe you wouldn't have as much credibility, which I think that's much what you're saying. But to put a little bit of a finer point on it, this is essentially what the Ran says. The Ran above Mitzia says, essentially, why does this not work? He says, because this is equal to another term that we've seen so far, but we haven't discussed at great length. He says, you know what this is? Nego mi mama mama, according to the Ran, who's going to say, I disagree with this, is, the problem is, nego mi mama mama equals a nego de ha'aza. Right? You remember we said that if you have an alternative claim, but the alternative claim is a chutzpah de claim, you're going to have to be very brazen to go to that alternative claim. Then we don't necessarily say you have that credibility. Right? In other words, your credibility is not automatically there, because the whole assumption is that you have equal access to this other time. But maybe there's an impediment to the other time, such as it would require more chutzpah than you could be assumed to have.
There's all cases that you were in the moment, so how far? So
it's a little bit of a question of degree, right? So how are we going to draw the line? But maybe it's going to roughly correlate that once you got to introduce another subject into the discussion, that's already a chutzpah. Now you're already saying that, believe me, because of some unrelated claim, maybe the average person does not consider himself automatically able to do that, automatically able to bring in some claim from a different subject, and therefore the premise of Migo, that, well, it could have just have easily said this, so therefore you're telling the truth now, maybe it's not true. Hi.
Just to clarify, so Migo, Mamon is a subcategory of Migo.
So it's a type of, that basically it would be a type of Migo da'aza. Right. Essentially, that's what the Ran says, that Mamon Lamamon means that you're saying a claim that's more a chutzpah than we would necessarily credit you with being willing to do. Morty?
I thought the Ran is not two different things. That means that the Oshin are in a Migo, but also the Dabar Az, which is coming a different meaning. That isn't that. That last line about Migo Mamon Lamamon?
You say it's a separate point?
Yeah.
It sounds like, I mean, you could read it as the same two things, but you could also read it as saying that they're essentially connected. That essentially this is a subset of the whole argument of Migo Da'aza, so therefore we don't claim that you're automatically live, you're automatically able to turn to a chutzpah claim, and the claim from somewhere else is also the same spirit as a chutzpah claim. That's not necessarily chutzpah per se, but that it involves the same impediment to credibility that we wouldn't say that you could just jump to another subject. Hi.
Can't we say clearer, more clearly, more simply, perhaps, mm-hmm. that if Migo is about beer, mm-hmm. then you can't use one case to be beer about another case?
Oh, so let's examine that for a second. Right? So, yes, if Migo is supposed to ascertain some kind of fact by itself, right? If Migo was supposed to try to uncover a fact about the case, what you might call direct evidence, right? So then you're right. So then the direct evidence is only relevant to facts of this case. But as we made the comparison last week, right, Migo was really more of a character witness. Right? All it's there to prove, if it's a credibility claim, that it's only there to prove that you are honest. So maybe we could say that your honest qualities could be established from somewhere else. Now, you're right, though, but let's think about it a little bit more directly. Is it really that you're honest like a character witness? No, it's really that you're telling the truth here. Right? That maybe you lied about other things, but if you're going to lie about this, then you'd probably take a better lie. So, it's interesting to pursue that line of thinking, that you could say that, yes, it's a biror about your credibility in this case, and therefore let's only consider your credibility as relates to this case, not as relates to some other issue.
You'd get it'd be stronger even if you were a liar. Like if you were known as a liar.
And yet you're credible here?
You would be credible here because then you would have more.
If we know that, that's interesting. It's very interesting, isn't it? If we know that you're willing to lie, right? And that you don't take a lie here, so all the more so you should be believed in this case. That is a little bit perverse, but it's...
I can think on that.
Sorry?
If we know that you're a constant liar, mm-hmm. then we know that you're... The reasons why you lie are not necessarily based on an irrational understanding of the situation. If you're a pathological liar, you can just be assumed to be lying, whether or not it is the most rational thing for you.
Okay.
There's the riddle, do you believe
right.
someone if they say, I always lie?
Right. So it's the inherent paradox. Right. Okay, that's very fascinating. So try that in court. Your Honor, you should believe me because I am very experienced at lying, and I usually lie much better than this. So if I was going to lie, this would not be my kind of lie. I'm way better a liar than this. It's an interesting possibility to consider. So, yeah, right. That's exactly the target point. Right, so this is one way to look at it, right? So basically, you could see just as far as tracking how this process of thinking goes. So on the one hand, you could say, all right, if Migo is about credibility, I've got no problem with Migo being on the run. Or you could say, no. You could say that Migo is a problem with credibility, but still, Mamun takes me outside my realm of credibility, just like Migo Da'aza, whether it's a form of Migo Da'aza or it's like Migo Da'aza, but it's outside my zone of credibility. Or you can then go on the other side and say, yeah, Mamun Lamamun is no good. So therefore, it's not about credibility, and it's about Koach HaTaina, let's say. And that is how some of the Achronim explain it. Again, as we mentioned, the Achronim are more into the Koach HaTaina than the Rishonim are. So Rabbi Chanan and the Kovet Shiurim and others explain it like this, that Migo is Koach HaTaina, that you have the full power of whatever claims are available to you. So that means whatever claims are available to you in this case. You can't take any claim from anywhere in the world. It means that within this argument, you're fighting over quadrants 3 and 4 of the Talos. So then whatever claims you have about that are relevant. But a claim from somewhere else is not a claim that you should have access to. Now, taking that a little bit farther, it's interesting. There was an article once in the Torah Vidas Journal. It's called Hamasifta. So a few years ago, I remember who wrote the article, who wanted to suggest as follows. It's related to what Basala was saying before, that maybe Migo Mimamun Lamamun doesn't work, because actually Migo Mimamun Lamamun is a form of migal lachotzi. And it's an especially bad form of migal lachotzi. In other words, I could say migal lachotzi does work, unless it's mama mama. Why? Because you could say that migal lachotzi should work, as we discussed last week, according to those Rishonim. Because you could say that whatever tainas I have, as the muhsak, I am entitled to the full scope of tainas that are available to me. So being the muhsak, if I have available tainas, it means that those tainas give power to my claim. So fine. So then, that's very good. Right? And maybe they're so powerful that they even work even beyond being the muhsak, even the hotzi from somebody else. If migo means you have the full tainas, then maybe even we could go so far as to say migo lahotzi. But if the taina is not from this case, it's from another case. So now you're really trying to shift reality. Right? When you and I are fighting over something, and I have claims available to me within this case, okay, so maybe Migo gives me the full power of those claims, so much so that even to be motzi from somebody else. But if it's not a claim from this case, and I want to bring that in and give myself that power, that's a form of working against the chazaka. That's a form of trying to upset the balance of this case in an unjust way. You follow? That you could give me very significant power as long as I'm using timings from this case. Even to say migo lahotzi. But the issue of lahotzi, that it upsets the chazaka in an unjustified way, that's certainly going to be the case if I'm not only trying to take away money from you, but I'm using a taina from outside this case completely. So that's just taking this idea further, that maybe even we could equate on some level migo lahotzi and migo mimamo mimamo and say they all share a common flaw. So one of the things that's emerging from these discussions is you see that we're talking about different details of migo lahotzi, migo na lahotzi, migo mimam lamamon, migo doso mamon, migo dahaza, migo na dahaza. And as we're seeing, sometimes they're all overlaid within each other, that maybe there's all just one big spectrum of how much power you have and you don't have, and all these different qualifications of lahotzi, mamon, lamamon, dahaza, they're all just different points along the spectrum which can shift the needle in one direction or the other. Some of the guys discussed this morning also the challenging language of the Ramban, that the Ramban seems to say that you don't get more migo points here because you could have claimed the whole talis, because the whole talis, a successful claim of the whole talis, would give you half the talis. Right? So now you're getting the half talis. You're getting the half talis part that you're asking for. So you would have gotten 50% with a whole claim, and you're still getting 50%. And for it to go the other way, we saw this in the language of the Ramban, that for you to get 100% based on a taina that wins 50%, that's not an effective type of migo. So some suggest that this is another way of saying that it's all about the koach ha-taina, and that essentially it has to be along the lines of the same taina that you're making. So 50% and 50%, it's all in one type of category. So I just think we'll leave a few points for tomorrow, but I just want to mention one more position in the Rishonim, especially because this is the point that most connects to the whole introduction that we gave about Kabbalah slash Hadar, so we certainly want to get to this point today. So did you see the Shita Mekubetzet post-Tosfos in Paris? Right, it's a very important position. What is his position? What's Rebbein Peretz's answer to this question? Why don't we say Migo here? Because he works off the assumption that Migo is essentially Madli L'Shaker. That why should I lie when I got better lies available? So, says Rebbein Peretz, here we're not necessarily talking about a liar. That when you have somebody who the issue is, are you lying or not? So then, Migo could be effective when you say that you have, you say that you have a better lie you could have taken. But here, we're talking about property, so it could easily be that neither party is lying, They're just arguing over who picked up first, did I pick it up together with you. They're arguing about their perception of the Metzius. So in that case, we don't necessarily know that one party is lying. So Migo is not going to be beneficial to support your claim if the issue is not one of honesty to begin with.
Why is that limited to only property? Meaning a matter of disagreement perception can happen by anything.
True, but some claims are not about that. Right, so some claims are, you know, if I say that I sold you this and you say, you know, I never bought it from you, I had it to begin with, I don't owe you any money, you know, we're making a wildly different factual claim about what we claim to know.
But once you, okay, fine. So but right. In that case, if it wasn't whether I sold it or whether I didn't sell it to you, but rather it's I said for $100 and you said for, and then, you know, if you guys are arguing about the price, that would be a case where
it would
be not
able to possibly, right, but also it also depends on how that's phrased. But theoretically, you know, there are machlokas in where two people are making opposite claims where they claim the other one would know that they're saying falsehood. But in the case of this conflict about property, so they both claim to be the one who found it, or that one claims that I found it all by myself, and the other one says, no, we picked it up together. Right, so in the claim of Chetz Shali, right, so essentially, what's the difference? So Aryeh is saying, they both, Aryeh and Morty both say they found this talus on the floor. And Aryeh says, I picked it up first, so it's all mine. And Morty is saying, no, we picked it up at the same time, so it's half yours and half mine. So neither one is necessarily lying. There's a dispute about milliseconds here, about who came first. So when we don't know that one is necessarily lying, so to bring in power from amigo is not relevant. So he seems to be working off the assumption that amigo is about sheker, and if sheker is not the concern, then that's not the case. It's not going to be relevant. He quotes a Gemara Nivamas on Daf Kofiudalid, where the Gemara says that if a woman claims that she wants to be able to remarry, so she claims that her husband died in the battlefield, so she's not necessarily believed. So but she could have said that he died in bed, and then we would believe it. Right, so why don't we say amigo? But if she says, she could have said he died in bed, we believe her. So if she says he died in the battlefield, we should believe her also. So as he explains, we can't apply amigo there because we don't think she's lying. We just think she doesn't really know. So when the husband's missing in war, so she'll come and claim that he died in the battlefield and he could be just missing, so she's not out there in the battlefield. She doesn't know one way or another. So the issue of her ne'amanus is not about her possibly lying. So the fact that if she wanted to lie, she could have said a better lie. That's not going to help us because it's not going to contribute to her credibility here, because ne'amanus, in this sense, is not about credibility. You might be lying, you might be telling the truth. It's about we don't know if you even know the truth in the first place. So again, this just kind of highlights this whole introductory topic that we had about the difference between liars and honest people and believability and non-believability. They don't always correlate the way people think. They're like, oh, if you're honest, everything you say is true. And that's not necessarily the case. And vice versa, that even if a person we know would only say the truth, but if this issue is not one that they're necessarily in a position to know about, so then their credibility may not count for anything.
So, according to Tessa's related parents, you could only be effective in a case where we can assume you're telling the truth if you are not lying.
Right, that's also true. That's part of it. But in addition to that, or more fundamentally than that, he's saying that the issue at hand is whether or not you're telling the truth. So, if we want to know, are you lying or not lying? So, the fact that you have access to a better lie means you're probably not lying in this
case. So, in cases where you could be telling the truth but still be wrong, he goes,
essentially, right. That's probably a good way to put it. So here, that's the case, right? Because so Morty could honestly think that he and Aryeh both picked up the garment at the same time. And that's why he's asserting his claim that maybe he's just wrong. So the question before the court is really, essentially, when he says it's all his and Morty says it's half his, so the question that the court's really wondering about is what happened? Did Aryeh pick it up first? Or did Morty and Aryeh pick it up at the exact same time? So Morty could be the most credible person on the planet. It's not going to make him more likely to be right or wrong about this, because he may still be wrong as far as assessing whether or not this is the case. Now, just mention, right, so again, I think this ties in very much to Kabbalah slash Hara. So just Halacha Maisa, I would like to argue on a very beautiful sefer that was published a few years ago, but I think this fact is very wrong, that it said that if somebody tells you that it says something about somebody in the newspaper, so you're allowed to be the makabel that it says that in the newspaper, because it's what we call a milsa David Leguye, that people don't lie about things that will ultimately come out. And since you could just open up the newspaper and see if you're telling the truth or not, so therefore you believe that it actually says that. So I think that that's not really correct. First of all, he's not even addressing the question whether the newspaper got it right. That's not even addressing that, okay? Saying it could be the newspaper got it wrong, which as we know is certainly very, very possible. But let's assume that's not even under discussion, that the person is not claiming the story is true or not true, he's just claiming it's in the newspaper, and that you should be allowed to believe that it's in the newspaper, whether or not it's true. But it's working off the assumption that people correctly understand what they read. And very often, that is not the case. And if you want to prove this point to yourself, go to any news website that has comments. Go to any news story aggregator that has comments in the bottom, and read through the comments and see how many people clearly do not understand the article that they're reading. Right? So it's you'll get a very depressing view of what percentage of people are ready to actually comment on the web when they haven't really fully processed the story. So especially people who just read headlines and they don't really understand what the story is getting at. So it very, very often happens people read something in the paper and they don't understand it. So they're telling you what they think is true. And yet, it's not true. So the fact that it's a milsa d'avud l'guye, the fact that, why would they lie when you can check up on them? They're not lying on purpose. They think they're telling you the truth. They don't know, though. When you read the article, it's going to say something different. And again, if you want to see how often this happens, just feel free to pick any random article and read the comments and see how many comments are clearly misunderstanding the article. And it's a pretty sad eye-opener. So again, it all goes to this point, that a person's credibility is only relevant when the only issue at hand is, are they lying, are they not lying? But when there's a big possibility that they could be honest people and honest over here, but still essentially not reflecting the truth, so then we don't know how much value we can give to it. So essentially that's what Ibn Parrots is saying. Okay, so it's great that he's not lying, but he might still be wrong. Just like the woman who thinks her husband died in the battlefield might still be wrong also. Now, parenthetically, that issue about the woman in the Aguna is a little bit more complicated because we do, the halacha, accord a lot of credibility to the woman in this case because we do assume that she's going to look into it very carefully, that Chazal made a chumrah, that there's a tremendous chumrah associated with the Aguna situation of a man who dies at war, that there's a tremendous, it's really a total disaster, Rahman al-Islam, if a woman gets married when she thinks her husband died and he didn't, then she has to divorce the new husband and the old husband, and it's a whole disaster. And Chazal explained that we want it to be as chumrah as possible because that's what allows us to be makel. That if we know the consequences to being wrong are very high, so that a woman is not going to remarry unless she's really 1,000% sure that her husband's not coming back. That she's 100%, 1,000% sure that he didn't survive. So we want that a woman who's going to remarry is going to look into it very, very carefully and only going to progress when she's really, really confident that that's the case. So therefore, we put all this chumrah on it. Chumrah mitoch kula shekalt betchila, marked to the sofer, the other way around. Mitoch chumrah shek marked to the sofer, kalt betchila, that since it was such a machmer situation at the end, that's why we're able to be makel at the beginning. The consequences are so great after the fact that we can therefore be lenient before the fact, because we can assume that there's real ne'amanus there to go off of, and that's why we allow them to remarry the eidecha. We normally require two eidim, but we can lower the threshold because we have extra ne'amanus from this. So it's a little bit of a complex mix as far as how the ne'amanus plays out, but in any event, Tosfos and Parrots makes the comparison between that type of ne'amanus and this type of ne'amanus, but the core point being that ne'amanus is only valuable if we can assume that the person either knows or has the capacity of investigating it thoroughly enough that when they say this is true, they have investigated it and it's likely enough to be true. So again, I think this ties in very strongly to some of the Yemei Hadin themes, and tomorrow in our shorter time together, I want to at least talk about Migo Da'az in a little bit more detail, which is also very Ksubis relevant, and the concept of Shvua. How does Shvua fit in? And then we'll take things from there. Okay, everybody good? Any questions? Any issues? All right, so we will catch Mincha now, and then we should have a wonderful day. See you tomorrow.